Another case of similar and similar journal was Voyage Round the World by Way of the Great South Sea of 1726, which was written by Captain George Shelbrock. Shelbrock described how the second mate shot a black albatross while they were rounding the Cape Horn of Cabo de Orma, which is more or less the same part of the world as Coleridge was talking about. Then there was the true story of the Octavius, a schooner that was found in 1775 with all of those on board frozen to death, some of them a little bit like sort of zombie sculptures, although they were at their posts, they were manning the thing, but frozen solid. So again, this sort of thing is happening. But at the same time, there are people like Joseph Banks. Do you know Joseph Banks? Joseph Banks was the botanist and I think a little bit of a zoologist who accompanied Captain Cook on his voyages and did all the scientific work while Captain Cook was exploring the coast of Canada and Australia and New Zealand and Fiji and these places. He shot several albatrosses and even published a recipe book for albatross. I don't know if that has any relationship to the scene in Monty Python. You know, I don't know if that's related or not, but that is he did that and there were no dire consequences. So the idea of killing an albatross is not necessarily there isn't necessarily an established myth of it bringing bad luck. There was several myths around the time. Some of them said that albatrosses brought bad luck, and so presumably killing them brings good luck. Others said that killing them brought bad luck. It's a little bit like, you know, black cats bring bad luck in Spain and good luck in Britain. But it was quite common among sailors to actually to make tobacco pouches out of albatross feet. Because it's waterproof, their feet are waterproof, and there's a big lot of skin, presumably you take the bones out and you put a, whatever, to keep your tobacco in. Killing albatrosses wasn't some sort of terrible stigma necessarily for things. So we have this quite a strong sense of this voyage around the world, and there is quite a strong relationship with the idea of crossing the equator, and the symbolism of the South Sea and the North Sea, and all of this type of thing going on. There's very much the idea of geography and of movement around the globe, without it being geographically specific. The fact that it's not geographically specific, but the fact that he doesn't go to Japan and here and there and places with names, partly because of exploration, but it's also, it makes it much more of a universal thing and much more dreamlike. So we have the feeling of being in the doldrums. Do you understand in the doldrums? There's certain places in both the Pacific and the Atlantic around the equator, where there are very few currents and very little wind often. And so often ships will enter these areas and then just get stuck. The Spanish called the doldrums in the equatorial Atlantic El Mar de Caballos. Do you know why? Typically, they threw the caballos overboard there because they couldn't feed them. So all sorts of unfortunate horses were drowned in this part of the Atlantic. But anyway, and that corresponds very much to what the situation that the ancient mariner finds himself in the tropical seas with no current, just stuck, no water, no rain, hot, humid, tropical situation. So there's very much this idea. It's not a fantasy in the medieval sense where you just go off to a land and it will just be a sea. You definitely get a feeling for the globe and the different parts of the globe, but not for toponyms as such. And that helps to create a dreamlike quality. There is very much the idea that this feels like a nightmare. That's the sort of thing which happens. There's a sort of causality. Things sort of make sense, but don't make perfect sense. Yeah? A little bit like life. But in a story, typically, what you have is a situation where things happen because. And the causality is very, very clear. Yeah? Much clearer than in real life. In dreams, things just sort of tend to move together, and you try and make sense of them afterwards. But it doesn't make complete sense. And that's very much what's happening here. We know that this man was addicted to laudanum. Everyone knows what laudanum is? Yeah, it's basically opium in drops. It's a convenient form of opium, if you like. Completely legal. Just go down to your apothecary or your pharmacist and they will give you laudanum or cocaine or whatever you like. Wonderful time to be alive. No social stigmas, no problems apart from not being able to write very good poetry sometimes. Most of these people are addicted to this type of drugs. They can carry on happily being functional romantic poets, but they are basically opium addicts in this liquid form. Which is, in the case of Coleridge, to be fair, he started taking it for arthritic pain. I mean, he wasn't taking it recreationally. People like Lord Byron took laudanum because it was fun. And actually, Lord Byron had quite a, was in control of it, whereas Coleridge wasn't. Coleridge made his family and friends and everybody suffer quite a lot because of his laudanum habits.